from yesterday. So what did we discover yesterday? Well, okay, so yesterday we looked at two experiments, single slit, double slit, and we noticed there were some peculiar properties of the behavior of small particles when they go through this single slit and double slit. Okay, and what we noticed is that this law, F equals ma, which is great, fantastic for describing the motion of baseballs, for cars, all that kind of stuff, for large objects, objects that are you know, of a size comparable to us. Okay, works great. But when trying to describe the behavior of these small particles, how they move through this apparatus, seems to not quite work. There's a certain sense in which it does work, which is fairly advanced, which we're not going to get into. But it doesn't seem to be obviously useful to us anymore. Okay. But what does seem to emerge from our analysis of the single and double slit is this relationship. We notice that lambda is h over p, or p is h over lambda, or just another way of writing it is just lambda times p is equal to h. This is the de Broglie relation. Okay, so what we found is that there seems to be some relationship between wave and particle properties. Okay, so we're starting with particles in the apparatus, which have some momentum p, but somehow, in some way, associated with that particle is a wave. The wave doesn't tell us how the particle behaves. The wave tells us something about the probability of the particle hitting the screen at various locations. Okay, so we start with a particle, and then we introduce a wave, and that wave allows us to calculate the probability pattern on the screen of those particles. Okay, so somehow the waves are associated with describing the behavior of those electrons. Okay, and there's this important relationship between that wave and the particles that we're dealing with. Okay, and the idea was, well, okay, instead of using this, let's try to use this to learn something about the nature or the behavior of electrons or small particles in some particular situation. Okay, and the situation that we looked at was a very important situation, and that was the particle in a box. Okay, so along the x-axis here, the ends of the box are at 0 and L, and what we did is we stuck a particle in there, and the only thing we said about the particle is it has a mass m, and it has some total energy E, and that energy is just kinetic. Okay. So we've given that particle some energy E, and we're trying to understand, well, what's it doing in the box? Okay. When we have this idea of a wave to contend with. Okay. And what we discovered is a whole bunch of interesting things. Okay. And I'm going to just sort of recap what it is we discovered, starting from the last thing and then working backwards. So at the end of the day, what we found is, if we look at the energy of the particle in that box, it turns out that it can't just have any energy. Okay, it can have only certain discrete allowed values of energy. Okay, so in particular, if this is no energy, the first allowed energy is above zero. This was what we called E0. And this is called zero-point energy. Okay, so even if we have a particle in a box, if we try to remove energy from it, we can remove energy, remove energy, remove energy, but we can never bring it to zero. Okay? It always has some, it's always doing something in that box, which has some kind of energy associated with it. And that turns out to be an extremely important property of our actual universe. Okay? And we will talk about that. As I mentioned last time, I just alluded to it, it explains how this table can exist. Okay? And we will see exactly how shortly. Probably tomorrow. Okay, so, and then the next allowed energy we called E1, which turned out to be just 4 times E0. So E0 is maybe down there. So 1, 2, 3, 4. And then the next one was E2, which was 9 times E0, and so on. It's actually squared. 2 squared is 4, 3 squared is 9, 4 squared is 16, and so on. Okay, so those were the allowed energy levels. And so that means that if it's in, say, this energy level here, if we tried to give it, say, this amount of energy, it simply wouldn't accept it. Okay? The only energy it would accept is this amount of energy, in which case it would jump to that, or this amount of energy, in which case it would jump to that, and so on. Okay, so certain discrete allowed energy level, that's quantization of energy. Okay? And then associated with each of these energies, the particle is in one of these energy states. Okay? It's associated with, there's a kind of a wave associated with it. Okay? And the wave function, the function which describes that wave, it's a standing wave. Okay? So that wave, when the particle has this much energy, the wave associated with it looks like this. It looks like a standing wave between the ends of the box, which oscillates up and down like that, with a node there and a node there. Okay? And the associated, and so what does this thing mean? Well, that's just the amplitude of the wave, okay? But what we're interested in is the square of the amplitude, because remember that what we're doing is we're associating, when we look at that double slit again, we have waves coming in like this, and we get this interference pattern here. If we take the amplitude of that wave and square it, that reproduces the particle probability pattern exactly. Okay, and so what we're interested in terms of the particles is the square of this wave. So if we take this thing squared, what we get is something that looks like that. Okay, and so what that's saying, this is a probability here. It's saying that if we look in the box, if the particle has this much energy, if we look in the box, we can't know in advance where the particle is going to be, where we're going to find it. Most likely we'll find it somewhere near the middle of the box, and very unlikely we'll find it near the ends of the box. Okay, so that's what that's saying. Okay, if the particle is in this state, so I'm using the word state, that's actually the word that's used in quantum theory, is the particle is in this state, because I don't really know how else to describe it. It's doing something, but that something is not anything like what we could imagine classically. It's not anything like the particle just bouncing back and forth like this. It's doing something really weird, and we're going to talk more about what it's doing. So it's in some kind of state, okay? And when it's in this state with energy E1, then the wave that's associated with it is, again, a standing wave, but now it has a node in the middle. Okay? And so instead of just one lump, it's got two lumps, okay? And this is going down, this is going up. Okay, and so it's going like this. That's our standing wave. But associated with that standing wave is a probability pattern. And what we do is we just take that wave and we square it. And so the probability pattern now looks like this. If we square a positive, we get a positive. If we square a negative, we get a positive. So we get two lumps. So it's saying if we look in that box, it's most likely to be found either here or here, but not very likely to be found here, here, or here, near the ends of the box or near the middle. Okay, so that's the interpretation. And finally, if we're, say, in this state, higher energy state, then the wave associated with it is again a standing wave, but now we have two nodes in the middle. And so the wave looks like that. Okay, it's a standing wave, like that, so just oscillating up and down like that. And the probability pattern associated with that, we square that, and now we just get three positive lumps. Okay, so if we look in the box, it's likely to be found in these locations, but not here, 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 or here. Okay, so that's that. So that's where we had gotten to last time, and let me just sort of emphasize a point here. In the classical or non-quantum picture, in the Newtonian universe, if the particle has some energy E inside that box, what's happening is, there's our particle. What it's doing is it is just bouncing off the walls back and forth like this. And so its momentum is either plus P or minus P. Okay? At one instant of time, it's going to the right. Momentum is plus P. At the next instant, it's going to the left after it's reflected off the wall. And this momentum P is related to the energy by just E equals P squared over 2m. So I can calculate P knowing the energy. Okay? In the quantum world, things are very different. In the quantum world, what we have is we don't have a definite trajectory. Okay, we can't follow the particle along and say, oh yes, it's bouncing back and forth like this. The only thing that we have is this probability pattern. So if we have particles here that are coming flying out like this into this double slit apparatus or through this double slit apparatus, you know, the first particle might hit there, the second particle might hit there, and so on. It's totally random where it hits. Okay? And if we allow that pattern to build up with flying a whole bunch of particles through there, we will get this pattern. Okay, but we can't actually follow the trajectory of any one of these particles and like we can there, follow the trajectory just oscillating back and forth. We don't actually know exactly what it's doing and getting from there to there. Okay, all that we can talk about are probabilities that when we look, we will find it there or there or there and there. Okay, we talk only about probabilities. And so maybe if it's in, say, this state over here, the probability pattern looks like that. Okay, and it's just saying if we look in the box, it's likely we'll find it there or there or there, but not likely here. So we've given up some kind of definite trajectory following its motion through space, and we have to accept the fact that there's all we can do is ask about probabilities of finding certain things to be true or not. Yeah.
Why can't we just make the box
small? We can make the box as small as we like. Yep, and we will talk about that exactly. The point is that if we start with a large box, the zero point energy. Do I have the formula for zero point energy? Does anyone remember what it is?
A squared over
L squared, right? So, m is the mass of the box. M is the mass of the particle. H is Planck's constant, so let's just take those as two given numbers. What we have that is adjustable is the size of the box L. So as we make the box smaller, this zero point energy gets bigger. Okay, so if we start with a big box, a wide box like this, the zero point energy is small. Okay, it's jiggling around in there doing some weird quantum thing, but it doesn't have very much energy. As we make that box smaller, say now this big, okay, we can make it as small as we like, the zero point energy gets more vigorous. Particles are claustrophobic. They don't like to be closed in like this, and they freak out. That's one of the questions on one of the exercises. How do you get from this state over here to this state? You squeeze the box smaller. In the process of squeezing the box, the energy goes up. But why? And you're going to think about that this afternoon. OK, excellent question. OK, so. In the quantum world, what we're doing is we're giving up this certainty, this definite trajectory of this thing just going doom, 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 doom. And we're just saying probabilities. At any time when I look in the box, I'll find the electrons there, whenever they're in there, there or there. The important point here is that in the quantum world, we are replacing plus P or minus P with plus P and minus P. This is one of the simplest ways to characterize the difference between classical and quantum world. Okay? So why am I putting an and here? Well, remember that essentially what happened yesterday, what we said is that the energy E is P squared over this. So we solve P is plus or minus square root of 2ME. Okay? We have a magnitude of momentum that's associated with some wavelength. Plus and minus tell us we've got a wave moving to the right. And then it bounces off the wall, means we've automatically got a wave moving to the left. Okay, and so simultaneously in the box, we have to have a wave moving to the right and moving to the left. Okay, and so in terms of a wave moving to the right plus a wave moving to the left just gives us our standing wave, which is this guy over here. Classically, that corresponds to a particle moving to the right and moving to the left at the same time. Okay, so that's a very, very important point. So basically, in order to have a standing wave, like we've got waves like this in the box, and that wave moves to the right, bounces off here and comes back, unless what we require is that that wave have a certain wavelength so that the wave moving to the right and the wave moving to the left interfere constructively. Okay? They're self-reinforcing upon multiple reflections. Okay? And that requires that both waves be present, a wave moving to the right and wave moving to the left at the same time. Okay, so. So introducing the very idea of a wave into our picture forces us to consider both that both possibilities are present simultaneously. right and left moving. And we will see a lot of this as we go along. Okay, so this is decidedly odd. And this is exactly where quantum mechanics is odd. Okay, that oddness shows up in all kinds of different ways, but there's one place. Okay, so that's that. Let's talk about something called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. How many of you have not heard of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle? Okay, so a few of you. Okay, so let's talk about that. That's a very important idea. And what it's going to give us is yet another way of understanding this weirdness. That and there is really weird. We're going to find another way of understanding the weirdness of quantum mechanics. Instead of writing that out all the time, we'll abbreviate it as HUP. Okay, so the first thing is we'll consider, okay, we've got our particle in our box here between these two endpoints here, between 0 and L. And let's suppose that our particle is in this state over here, okay, the lowest energy state, this is the ground state or the state or the 0 point state. Okay, so what we know is its probability pattern or probability distribution looks like that. Okay, so let's put that in. Looks like that. So this is P0 here. So it tells us that, you know, we don't actually know where the particle is at any given time, but if we look, it's likely to be found near the middle of the box and not near the ends. Okay? What is in this state, what is the wavelength of the particle? How is it related? What is L? How is L related to the wavelength? Yeah. So L is equal to lambda over 2. Okay, and you can see that from here. We're in this state over here. This is the standing wave. This is 0 to L. Okay, so this is half a wave because a full wave is like that. This is a full sine wave. Okay, so one wavelength is this, so that's half a wavelength. So the size of the box in this state corresponds to half a wavelength. Okay. So now the next question we ask is, what is the uncertainty in the position of that particle? What is our uncertainty in the position? So let me just clarify here. The symbol delta, as used in most places in physics and mathematics, delta means change in. So when you say delta x, you mean change in position. In quantum mechanics, the symbol delta means uncertainty in. So let's just write uncertainty. There are only a finite number of symbols in the Greek alphabet, so sometimes they get used for two different things. Okay, so uncertainty in the position. What would you say is the uncertainty in the position? Like, we know it's in the box somewhere. We know for sure it's not outside the box. It's somewhere in the box, but we don't know where. So how uncertain are we of its position? How is that related to the size of the box? Yeah.
Isn't it related more so to the probability curve than to the size of the box? Because, like, we know it's in the box, but until we measure exactly where in the box it is, we have to use the probability curve to, like, determine the probable places it could be. So it doesn't have to determine.
Okay, but in any one of these probability curves, say we're dealing with this one, or this one, basically, it's basically evenly spread throughout the box, right? I mean, besides these zeros, like if we go up to many, many, like a very, very high state, you know, looks like this. It's basically evenly spread throughout that box. So we have no idea where it is, right? I mean, if we take a measurement, we have no idea in advance where we're going to find it. It could be found over there. 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 So we are completely uncertain. In any of these states, we are completely uncertain of where it is inside the box, of where exactly it is. We do know it's not outside the box. So what's our uncertainty? Yeah. Yes. It does. It does. Yeah, so that's a good point. So here's our box. And we're in any one of these states here. Say the number one state, E1. And so what this thing tells us, it's likely to be found here or here and so on and so forth. But we know for sure it's not outside. So the curve actually extends outside the box, but it's zero outside the box. It actually looks like that. Yeah.
Is there any chance of it going right?
There's no chance of it being found at any exact position, right? So what you can do is you can say, so here's our probability curve like this. And the probability that it's found at exactly that location when I look in the box is zero. So what you need to do is you need to actually consider a small range. Call this what should we call this? Delta X, a different kind of delta. Okay? Yeah. Yeah, but we're talking about beforehand. So beforehand, what is the probability of finding it at any exact location is zero. So what you can do, so what these P curves actually mean is this. If I take P, say we're taking P1, so this is this, or this is P0, this is P0 here. If I take P0 and evaluate it at that location, okay, and I multiply by delta X, by that small width here, that's the probability I would find it in that small width. Right?
Wow.
Because the probability I will find it at any given, like at one single point.
Is it like a fucking zero or exactly?
It's exactly zero. The probability of finding it at exactly one, at exactly that point, is zero.
But after you find it, like say
that you before you look. So it's a probability, yeah, the word is a probability density. Okay, so but that may not be very helpful. So let me say it this way. So if you introducing some unknown terminology doesn't always help. So what it means in terms of, I guess maybe I could just introduce a calculus concept here. Stefan had mentioned this a little bit, integration. Integration is the area under the curve. So basically these curves are such that that the area under the curve is equal to 1. Okay, so the probability of finding it somewhere in the box is 100%. And that number, 100%, that number 1 comes from the area under the curve. Okay, so the probability of finding it in this little range over here is the area under the curve, is the area of that little rectangle. So the probability of finding it, say, in the right half of the box is the area under here, which is 50%, a half. The probability of finding it somewhere in the right half is 50%. The probability of finding it, say, in this little region over here is the area under the curve here, which might be 10%. Okay, so the probability of finding it, say, within this range over here is the area of that little rectangle. And as you shrink that rectangle to zero, the probability of finding it at any exact location is zero. You need to be, your detector has finite width. When you stick a detector in there, the detector does not detect particles at an exact location. It has some width, some physical
so
size.
The particle itself, is it at an exact location?
No. See, that's one of the things. We don't know actually what the particle is doing in there.
So because we can't have an infinitely accurate detector, there's no probability of having an accurate
detector. No, OK, supposedly in principle we could have an infinitely accurate detector. Then we would stick that infinitely accurate detector, which detects the probability that the particle is in that super tiny little range. And it's just, it's almost zero. Yeah, so it could detect the particle, whether it's at an exact location. That's right. So it can detect a particle at an exact location. It's a very, very tiny detector like this. But the probability that when you find it, suppose that instead of a probability curve like this, we have a probability curve like this. It's equally likely to be found anywhere in the box. Okay. The probability that it's exactly at that or in a super, super narrow range like that is basically the width of this divided by the total width.
Yeah, now I hear you saying that wrong, but I don't want to take it.
Okay, yeah.
of B1,
yeah,
was two waves. So exactly in the middle, when it's like mu zero, is it exactly zero or it's just mu zero?
So this curve does go to zero right at that location.
So there is no chance of finding any particle in this point, right?
Yeah, so using his like infinitely accurate particle detector, if you stuck it at that point, you would never find the particle there.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. But any realistic detector would have some finite width, and it's the area under that little curve, which is a small thing. It's maybe 1% chance that you would find it in an area in a region of that width. Yeah.
But the reason why it is exactly zero, we don't need to find an exact point, then we have an infinite number of points, and then we have the probability for every of these points, then it's zero.
Wouldn't it be just an infinitesimal or whatever?
Yeah, so
it can be 1 divided by infinite, right? Which isn't exactly 0. It's just only like approximately 0.
Like in sense to be.
Yeah. So the probability of finding it at any point tends to 0.
Like, yeah. Yeah, let's say it that way. Are we happy with that? Okay. Right, okay. So basically, getting back to our uncertainty in the position over here, how uncertain are we when it's in this state? How uncertain are we of its position? Thank you, L. Okay, so basically we know that if we look in the box, we know that the particle will be found here plus or minus basically half the size of the box. Okay, so it's like when you make a measurement in physics and you say, well, you know, what is the length of this thing? Well, you stick a ruler up against it and you say the length is, you know, 5.2 plus or minus 0.1 meters. Okay, so our uncertainty is basically when we stick the meter stick against and how, you know, and compare it with the gradations and so on and so forth, how uncertain are we? Okay, it could be anywhere between 5. What does that mean? It means it could be anywhere between 5.1 and 5.3. Okay, we're not sure exactly. So we're not sure exactly of the width. It could be anywhere between 5.1 and 5.3. So our uncertainty is 0.1 meters. Same thing here. If we look in the box, we would say, well, the particle, we will find the particle here plus or minus this. So it could be basically anywhere inside the box. So our uncertainty is basically this, which is half of the width of the box. The width of the box is lambda over 2, so that's lambda over 4. Okay, so we are uncertain of its position. And the uncertainty of the position is basically the size of the box, or half the size of the box. Okay, so all right, so let's. So this is looking at the particle in terms of its position. Let's look at the particle in terms of its momentum. Okay, so if this is zero in momentum, what momentum does the particle have in that state? Yeah, so it's plus or minus p. So p was h over lambda, the magnitude of p. So the momentum of the particle is basically, let me turn all the way here. The momentum of the particle is basically lambda over h and negative lambda over h. Okay? So remember, in this picture here, what we know is that the particle is in some kind of a weird, indefinite state, in which it is simultaneous, it possesses a momentum plus p and minus p simultaneously. Okay, so if we were to actually measure, we would find either plus p or minus p. But before we measure, we don't know what it's going to be. It's in basically both states. Okay, and so our uncertainty. So we would describe the if we describe this measurement, we would say the measurement result will be zero plus or minus lambda over h. So our uncertainty in momentum, it could be either this or this, is uncertainty in momentum is just lambda divided by h. Okay, are we reasonably okay with that? Yeah.
Is equals to h divided by lambda and delta is equals to h. So it's two different
things. Oh, I'm sorry. I wrote down the wrong.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
So I'm dyslexic in a different kind of way, the up-down way. Okay. Oh, okay, it's all wrong in the graph. Oh, see, that's where I went wrong. Okay. Thank you. Gotcha. Okay. So, so let's ask a question here. Let's just for the fun of it, let's take the product of these two. What is the product of delta x and delta p? H over 4. So delta x is lambda over 4. We're multiplying by h over lambda. And so we notice that something interesting happens. The wavelength cancels out, and we get just a number, h over 4, which is independent of the wavelength. Okay? So that's an important relationship, and we will see more of this just in a second. Okay? So now let's ask another question. Let's start with this setup over here, but let's squeeze the box. Let's try to make the box smaller. We will keep it in the ground state. We'll keep it in the lowest energy state here, but we will squeeze the box. Okay, so we squeeze inwards like this, and so our box is now smaller. It's like this. Okay, but it's still in the ground state. So the probability curve looks like that. It's still P0. What is L in this case? How is it related to lambda, the wavelength? It's still lambda over 2. Okay? So our uncertainty in the position, we would say, okay, it could be found anywhere in the box when I look. So before I look, I don't know where it is. So I would say that the particle is here plus or minus half of the width of the box, so plus or minus lambda over 4. Okay, so the uncertainty in the position, same expression, is still lambda over 4. Okay, what about the momentum picture? Here's P and here's 0. We know that the momentum of the particle in this state, the magnitude of the momentum is h over lambda. So the momentum could either be plus h over lambda or minus h over lambda. Okay? Now, because we squeezed the box like this, we've made the box smaller. What has happened to lambda? This is smaller. So lambda is smaller. So h divided by lambda is what? Bigger. Okay, so in that picture there, we had the two here, but now they get spread out. Okay, now this is plus h over lambda, and this is minus h over lambda. Okay, so our uncertainty in the position, in the momentum, what's our uncertainty momentum? Same thing. It's still h over lambda. We would say, you know, one measurement might yield this, plus one measurement might yield that, but in advance we don't know which one, so we're uncertain. It's in this indefinite state in which both are present simultaneously. So we say uncertain momentum is still this, but it's larger now because lambda is smaller. Okay, so what's important here is by squeezing the box, we have made our uncertainty in the position, which is still given by lambda over 4, smaller because the wavelength is now smaller. Okay. Corresponding to that, the uncertainty momentum has increased. Okay, so basically what's happening here is what I mentioned before, particles are claustrophobic. Okay, so basically if they're in a big box, this 0-point motion, whatever that is not very vigorous. If we make the box smaller, and so pin down the location, we know for sure now it's in a smaller space. We know the particle is now in that box, but the box is smaller, so we've pinned down its location. We're more certain of its position. Then the particle freaks out and says, I don't like you to be certain of my position. And so it freaks out, and it has this huge uncertainty momentum. Okay? The vigorousness of that 0-point motion becomes greater. Okay, so this is claustrophobic. Okay, so but I want you to notice something. Even though delta x is smaller and delta p is larger, what is the product of delta x and delta p? So delta x and delta p is still the same. Okay, so what we notice is that there seems to be this universal relationship between uncertainty in position and uncertainty in momentum. If we make delta x smaller, if we become more certain of the position of the particle, so this guy goes down, then correspondingly the uncertainty in momentum goes up, and vice versa. such that the product of the two always remains the same. Okay, so that's important. And now let's talk about one last thing here. Let's give one more example. Suppose we're not in the ground state. Suppose we're in an excited state, okay, one of the higher energy states. In fact, let's take the state E3. Okay, so that means we're dealing with the probability pattern P3. So we know that P0 has one lump in it. P1 has two lumps. How many lumps does P3 have?
Four lumps.
Four lumps. Excellent. Okay. One, two, three, four. Okay, so that's P3. Okay. So again, our delta x now, so this is L and this is 0. What is L in terms of the wavelength? How many wavelengths are now inside the box? Two, right? Because we basically squared this sine wave and this sine wave to get these four lumps. So we've got two. L is 2 lambda. So our uncertainty in the position is now what? Lambda. Okay, so the particle could be anywhere in that box. It could be there plus or minus half of the width of the box, which is lambda. Okay, and similarly, delta P, the momentum is always just h divided by the wavelength, the magnitude of the momentum. So our uncertainty momentum, it could be either plus this or minus this. So delta P is h over lambda, as before. Okay, what is the product now? The lambdas cancel out when we take the product, and we get just h. Okay, so in the ground state, we got that the product was h over 4. In an excited state here, we got a bigger number, h. A quarter h went to a full h. Okay? So in general, the relationship is this. The product of delta x and delta p is greater than or equal to h over 4. Okay? And if you do the math properly, if you if you do Schrodinger's equation and properly define these uncertainties and so on and so forth, there's a factor of pi that appears. Okay. So actually, when Heisenberg first wrote this down, this relationship, he just said that it's some number related to h, proportional to h, some number of that order of magnitude. Okay. So that's that. So let's try to make some sense of this relationship. This relationship is very similar to this. So this is called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, and this is called the de Broglie relation. Okay, so you'll notice that they're very similar. Here's a length, here's a length, here's a momentum, and there's an h. So in fact, what we did is we derived this from this, sort of. Okay, up to that factor of pi there, okay, which doesn't really matter. Okay, so let's think about what this Heisenberg uncertainty principle is telling us. This is truly remarkable. So remember, the idea here is we are going to get another way to understand the weirdness of our quantum world. Okay, so there are different interpretations of this relationship. Okay, quantum mechanics is mathematically, the mathematics is fairly simple. You know, once you learn how to take derivatives and so on, you've got the Schrodinger equation, and the math is pretty simple. And everyone agrees on the math and all that stuff. But what is actually happening, what that mathematics is telling us about the nature of the universe, well, that's a wide open question. Okay, we have, like, people in this institute who have devoted their lives to trying to answer that question, to trying to wrap their minds around that question. And those are people working in an area called the foundations of quantum theory. Okay, so there are different interpretations of this relationship, what it's trying to tell us about the nature of our universe. And you're going to have a keynote talk in a few days now from a guy called Jos Ufink, and he's an expert on interpretations of this. So I think you're going to have a lot of fun. So I'm going to give you a simple interpretation of this, which I would call the strong interpretation of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Okay, there's also weaker interpretations and so on and so forth. Okay, and Jos will fill you in on all of that. So strong interpretation is that, I'll just write it down and then we'll talk about it. Particle cannot simultaneously possess So a particle cannot simultaneously possess a definite position and a definite momentum at the same time. Okay, so to say that it has a definite position means what about delta x, about our uncertainty in its position? Very low. If it's definite, if we know definitely where the particle is, how can we, in our particle in the box, how can we be know definitely where the particle is in the world? How could we do that? We make the box really, really small. We've got a particle in that box. I know that particle is in this box here. I've got it trapped in there. What I do is I squeeze the box and make it really, really tiny. Okay, now I've got this tiny, weeny little box. I know the particle's in there. I've localized its position. I know for sure. I don't know where in the box it is, but the box is really small, so I've but I know the particle is in this very small space. Okay, so That's exactly the point. So to say that it has a definite position means that our uncertainty in the position is zero. Okay, or there is no uncertainty in its position. It occupies a definite position. It is at a definite location. It is at x equals 5, period.
Well, that, if this is true, then that couldn't occur, right?
Exactly, that's the point. So, and simultaneously, okay, and to say that it has a definite momentum means that the momentum is exactly 5 kilogram meters per second with no uncertainty. Okay, so that's what it means to say definite. So that means our uncertainty in the momentum is zero. Okay, and so what the Heisenberg, according to this interpretation of the Heisenberg uncertainty, is saying that you can't have that. You can't have this thing zero and this thing zero at the same time, because zero times zero is zero, but we need a number on the right-hand side here that's bigger than h over 4 pi. In a Newtonian universe, there is no Planck's constant, and this is just zero on the right-hand side. And you can have a definite position and a definite momentum simultaneously. But in the quantum world, we can't have both of these zero at the same time. Yeah. So there are interpretations in which it's saying, see, the weaker interpretation is that you can't measure both of them with infinite precision. But the particle can have, yeah.
So does this equation destroy the idea of like absolute rest then? Because if you can't occupy an exact position or have an exact momentum at the same time, then you must always be.
Yeah, so to say that the particle is just sitting there, so what it's saying is you can't have a particle just sitting there. Because if a particle is just sitting there at some definite location, right, then delta x is zero and it has no momentum because it's just sitting there. Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
It's more disturbing, so the particle has a definite position.
Yeah, so okay, so the weaker one says that if you make a measurement and you measure the position of the particle to an accuracy of delta x, so your detector is, say, this big, and so you know I've detected the particle somewhere in this region, then by making that measurement, you introduce an uncertainty in its momentum, whose magnitude will be delta p is greater than or equal to, just bringing the delta x down here, h over 4 pi delta x. So the more certain I am of its position, the more accurately I measure its position, the more I disturb it and give it an arbitrary random momentum. And so my uncertainty momentum of the particle at the same time as I know its position has increased. Well, not according to the strong interpretation. So I could interpret this also as saying that the particle does not particle simply does not possess a definite position and momentum simultaneously. So there's just different interpretations of that one relation. Yeah.
Because this law like works only for small particles, right? But where is this border between small particles? I mean, where does it stop working? I mean, where is the border between small particles and electrons?
Yeah, that's a hugely important question. So the question is, all of this weirdness that's going on at the level of atoms and subatomic particles and so on, that's all fine and well, and it's all really cool, and maybe we can do cool things with it, et cetera, et cetera. But as we make systems bigger and bigger and bigger, until we get to the size of people in this room, we don't see this kind of behavior and so on. So where exactly does that transition happen?
So it's like this.
That's
like
an open question.
This diminishes, when going for bigger and bigger orbits, right?
Yeah.
So it stops at one point and.
Yeah, I mean, suppose it's true that this whole quantum nature continues all the way up to this sort of classical level. Okay, then because h is so small, okay, when I measure your position, okay, your position is being measured to a certain accuracy. This number is actually fairly big, even though we try to make it really, really small. It's fairly big compared to atoms. Okay, so this number is actually fairly big. So our uncertainty position needn't be super, super large. Okay, so at the level of objects that are the size of people in this room and so on, this relationship doesn't really have any bearing. Yeah.
Although they say that it cannot simultaneously possess a definite position and momentum,
yeah.
But can delta x ever be zero?
Yeah. So delta x could be zero. If you had his super accurate particle detector, then yeah. So delta x could be zero, but in that case delta p would be huge.
Wouldn't it violate that though? I mean, if delta x was
exactly zero. That's right. So in the limit that delta x becomes really, really, really small, delta p becomes really, really, really large.
This would actually say then that delta x could never be zero, right? So you could never be sure exactly of the definite position.
But delta p could be simply infinite. Okay.
Infinity is zero.
No. Zero times infinity is anything. Okay, and it depends upon the way something goes to zero and the way something goes to infinity. Like, I can take, say, 1 over x times x as x goes to zero. As x goes to zero, this becomes an infinity and this goes to zero. But the product of those is just 1. Okay? Or I could take 5 over x. Okay. As x goes to 0, this goes to infinity, and this goes to 0. I'm multiplying infinity times 0, but the answer is now 5. So basically, 0 times infinity is anything. Okay. But so in all of this stuff, let's just put it this way. In all this stuff, let's just say that we're not actually going to 0. We're just taking the limit. Okay. But we're not actually assigning the value to 0. Okay. Yeah.
You just multiplied velocity with mass, so we don't have any velocity that's higher than c. And
well, let me say this. That's a good point. That's a clever point. Okay. So let me say this. This important point is that all of this quantum mechanics that we're doing right now is based on Newton's picture of the universe. Okay. It turns out that because what are we doing? We're saying that all of the stuff we've done is based on this, E equals p squared over 2m. So kinetic energy is p squared over 2m. Okay, this is a formula which is valid in Newtonian mechanics. And that momentum is mass times velocity and so on. These are Newtonian concepts. In reality, we have, in relativity, we have E squared equals m squared c to the fourth plus p squared c squared. Okay. And so the relationship between energy and momentum is more complicated than this. In the limit of things moving slowly with respect to the speed of light, this reduces to, and do we have an exercise that we do this in? It's in the math primer thing. Yeah, yeah. So this reduces to E equals mc squared, so it's approximately. If the speed of the object is much less than the speed of light, you can show that this relationship reduces to E is approximately mc squared plus p squared over 2m. Okay, so this is the usual kinetic energy term. This is the rest energy. This is the amount of energy something has just by virtue of its inertia. If you could convert that mass into pure energy, there's a lot of energy there. Okay, that's called the rest energy. This is just a constant. Okay? So all of the stuff that we're doing is non-relativistic, non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Okay, but if you combine quantum ideas with relativity ideas, then you do get something which does make sense in the context of relativity, in the context of there being a speed limit in the universe.
With the velocity of light, that the mass increases, and therefore the momentum.
So this is this relationship here. Where does that come from? P equals mv. Yeah, so who, but someone wrote it down for the first time. Why? Why did they write that down?
What's the Newton coming for?
I think that she says that momentum can be infinite because when speed is very, very large, like the speed of light, mass also increases very, very fast. So
all I'm saying is, yeah, sure, I agree. I understand that all the stuff we're doing is invalid when it comes to things moving near the speed of light. And what we have to do is take all of what we've been talking about and put it in the context of special relativity. And when you do that, then you get something called quantum field theory. And that results in predictions of things like there exist things like photons, certain properties of the electron, spin, and all kinds of stuff like that. So basically, if you take ordinary quantum mechanics and combine it with special relativity, you get this thing called quantum field theory. And I'll talk a little bit about quantum field theory shortly, but let me actually get to it. So let me just say, let's suppose that we're reasonably okay with that. Okay? And let's just say, let's just have a look at what it means. Because we do want to eventually break for lunch. Okay, so but you see, what's wonderful about quantum is that this mathematics is open to many interpretations. Okay? And there's this kind of debate happens like hugely in this institute. Okay? So anyway, so in the classical picture, like if half of those quantum foundations people were to hear me yakking about this, they'd be horrified, and the other half would be, yeah, that's all right. But if I were to say something different, then that first half would be happy, and the other half wouldn't. Okay, it's a tightrope here. Okay, so in the classical world, the typical question that we ask is this. Okay, the typical question is, given the initial position and the initial velocity, or equivalent momentum, of a particle, what, at t equals 0, say, what is the position and the momentum at some later time t? Okay? So a concrete example is I give you the initial position of the baseball and the initial momentum. So I give you x at time 0 and p at time 0. If I've given you that and I've told you that there's a gravitational field, et cetera, et cetera, you apply f equals ma and you can tell me the trajectory of that particle. And you can tell me in particular the position and the momentum at any later time t. It's following some definite trajectory in space. Okay? This is time 0, and this is time t. Okay, so the point is, at any instant of time, the particle possesses a definite position and a definite momentum. As time goes on, first it's here with that momentum, then it's there with that momentum, and so on and so forth. At any instant of time, it possesses a definite position and momentum. So the fact that these guys are definite means that our uncertainty in position and our uncertainty in momentum are both 0. Okay? So the particle is on a definite trajectory. It can be on a definite trajectory. Or to be on a definite trajectory is a necessary condition for that, is delta x and delta p are both 0 simultaneously, which we know in the quantum world can't be true. Okay, so, or according to this strong interpretation of the Heisenberg uncertainty. Okay, so now let's compare that with the quantum world, which is very different. So in the quantum world, so this is a typical question. In the quantum world, the typical question changes radically. So what the typical question is something like this. Given I know that the particle was at this position at time zero, using his infinitely accurate position detector, what is the probability of finding the particle at some position x at a later time t? Okay, or given that I saw a particle moving with some velocity at time zero or having some momentum at time zero, what is the probability of finding that it has some momentum p at some later time? Okay, so it's either or, it's not both. Okay, so let's focus on the first one, which is the usual one. Okay, given that I saw a particle at some position, what's the probability of finding it at some later position? So what I have in mind here, or helpful to give you a concrete example, is at t equals zero, I saw I know the particle is here. It just emerged from that detector. Okay, what is the probability that at some later time I will find it occurring here? Okay, so what's the probability it will hit the screen at that point there, or in some range here? That's the kind of question. So that's it. So what do we use to calculate that probability? Well, we don't use F equals MA. We use lambda equals H over P. Okay, so okay, we see that to calculate probability. That probability there. Okay? So again, so what I'm getting to is there's no such thing as a definite trajectory. Okay, so let me illustrate this. So in quantum mechanics, according to this strong or one interpretation of the Heisenberg uncertainty and quantum mechanics in general. What we are,
Sorry, was there a question? Did you have a question?
Yeah. Why can't I know the both at some time?
This should make your
point. Oh, did I say that wrong?
Oh, yeah. Because you can calculate both probabilities.
So, let's just focus on this one over here, right? Are we okay with that? So what I'm saying is, I know the particle's here at this time. What's the probability to be there at a later time? That's the kind of question we're asking. Oh, because you can't know the initial position. And so given that I know at t equals 0, the position is this, and the momentum is definitely this. So I can't know definitely both of them. That's why it's only either or. That's right. So if I know the initial position exactly, then I know nothing about its momentum.
Yes.
And it could have any momentum.
So I cannot say because I'm going to have it at a different time.
Yeah, it's only. Sure, I can. That's right. I can't say definitely where it's going to be, but I can give probabilities. let me say it this way. Suppose that I got that particle, and I'm thinking in three-dimensional space, and I said, yes, it's right there. Okay, and then and I have this double slit apparatus over here. Okay, then there's an uncertainty in momentum that's introduced. Okay, so it has its momentum is totally uncertain. Okay, it could be in any direction. So then you say, well, first of all, there's only a 50% chance that the particle has a momentum such as moving to the right. Okay, so I know there's a 50% chance that it will even like enter the region of this double slit apparatus. And then of those, of that 50%, I can say there's a certain percentage, roughly speaking, that it's going to be going through these slits. Maybe 10% that a particle is going to go through those slits as opposed to just bouncing off the barrier. And then of those 10% that are actually going through that slit, now I apply my usual double slit probability pattern, and I say, okay, so it's 10% times this probability, this usual probability curve. So even though the momentum is totally uncertain here, it could have gone off in any direction with perfect spherical symmetry, I can still say there's a certain probability that it will actually end up over there. So I can still calculate probabilities. Okay, so let me just end with this one thing here, which I think you're really going to like. Okay, so let's go back to the double slit. And let's think about this a bit more. This is a famous thought experiment due to Richard Feynman. Okay, so within a certain interpretation of quantum mechanics, which is called the Copenhagen interpretation, this is what he thought about here. So let's start with our double slit. And what we're saying here basically is, actually let's go back to the particle in the box. So for the particle in the box, what we had is that all we can do is talk about probability patterns. And when the particle is in a state like this, there's a wave that is associated with that particle, which is a standing wave. And that standing wave involves a right traveling and a left traveling wave, left moving, right moving wave. Okay, and so what we have is plus p and minus p. Okay, so we have both classical possibilities present simultaneously. Okay. In the double, if we apply that kind of reasoning here to the double slit experiment, then when we say, oh, okay, what's the probability that the particle, you know, I see it over here at this time, what's the probability it will end up somewhere on the screen at some later time? What's the probability, say, that it will end up over there? Okay. Well, in getting from there to there, there's two ways that it could happen classically. One way is it could go through that slit. The other is it could go through that slit. There are two possible paths. Okay, so there are two classical alternatives, two classical probabilities. In the same way that for the particle in the box, there are two classical alternatives. It's either plus p or it's bounced around and it's minus p. But in the quantum world, we can, so this is plus p or minus p in the classical world. In the quantum world, we can have both of those alternatives present at the same time. Okay, so what quantum mechanics is saying is that, or in this interpretation of quantum mechanics, in the particle in getting from there to there exists simultaneously in this path as well as that path. Okay. In other words, at some instant of time, say here, the particle is simultaneously here and here. Okay. So that's what's being said. Okay. In this interpretation, other interpretation, like the many worlds interpretation, says that basically the electron is going to make a decision to go this way or this way. The electron only goes this way or this way, but the universe essentially splits into two universes. In one universe, the electron goes this way, and the other universe, the electron goes that way. So every time a particle has a decision to make like this, the universe splits into two. In one universe, it does this, and the other universe, it does that. You can imagine that at the atomic level, zillions of such things are going on. Zillions of such things are going on in my baby finger. Okay, there are zillions. My baby finger is creating zillions of new universes every split second. Okay, so that's the other, you know, possibility. Okay, so, you know, whatever. Okay, so let's go with this one for now. Okay, so it's saying it exists simultaneously in these two states. Now think about this. This is a really cool thought experiment. Let's say that now, instead of two slits, we add, say, a third slit over there. So in the particle, the particle in getting from there to there now, there are now three possibilities, this one, and that one. Okay? If we add another slit over here, that adds a fourth possibility. Okay? So now, in getting from there to there, the particle exists simultaneously in all four possible states. Okay, but what happens if we put another barrier here, like this, and introduced another slit, more slits? Okay, so here's another barrier, and we put, say, let's suppose we put a slit over there and another slit over there. Okay, so now the particle could do this, and then it has two possibilities, this or this. Or it could come this way and then go through this one or that one. Or it could come this way and go through that one and that one. Or it could come through this one and go through that one and that one. So we have 4 times 2 is 8 possible paths. Okay, and so the idea then is, in getting from there to there, the electron exists in all eight possible paths. Okay, so then Feynman just went to the limit of this and said, well, what if we stick a whole bunch of barriers in here, okay, and we introduce zillions of slits in each one of those barriers? Okay, so now it basically is a mess. So now we got these zillions of slits, and or zillions of barriers with zillions of slits, and so it can go like this. That's one possibility. Another possibility is this one. Right? Another possibility is this, and so on and so forth. And now let's introduce an infinite number of barriers with so many holes drilled in it that there's no more barrier. Okay, it's just empty space. And so the logical conclusion is that in getting from A to B here, the electron exists simultaneously in some weird way in all possible paths, including one that goes to the moon and comes all the way back. Okay? That's like really freaky. Okay? So there you go. So have some lunch on that one. All right. Time. We're done.